and what the city could do to help boost the economy in the city. We had, you might say, two boarded-up buildings, and we had some businesses that were failing in town, and the business people was very concerned. So, being a liaison between the city council and the chamber board, we set out to try to do something. We did not know at that time what it was going to be, and then the Main Street 78 project came up where we were going to try to use the capital taxes under the 1978 capital tax act. But it was turned down by the voters. I didn't like to say that on behalf of the chamber board, I went to city council and asked them if we could have that project to see if we couldn't get it passed, because the business community felt that we needed something like that to boost the business in the city. So they said, sure, you know, they couldn't do anything with it, so if you want to try it, go ahead. They kind of, council at that time chuckled about it, I think, I'd say, because they felt that how could we do it if they could. But again, like I say, as the president of the chamber, I had a good board. Without a board such as that, nobody can accomplish anything. So it was seven of us, not one person, who accomplished the feat. And those seven people went out and we formed different committees, and we obtained people in the community, business people, citizens, who were interested in the future of the downtown area. And by the time we got off through, we had gone door to door, passed out leaflets, explaining the program, explaining that it's city property, property that is owned by the city residents, people that are owned by the citizens of the community, owned the property that we were going to renovate and fix over. And we must have had 50 or 60 people then who went door to door and explained this program to all the citizens. When the city council did it, it was defeated by a 3.5-1 margin. After our chamber got through with it, and we called for a special election, and that special election, again, was not a cost to the city, because, we got all of the election workers to handle the polls that day. And so this is how the enthusiasm built up. And, you know, the city. And it passed by a better than 3-1 mark. And that was accomplished within a 4-month period.
That's beautiful.
And that's how we came about with our Main Street 78 project. But it, I was complimented by the mayor at that time, who said to me, Paul, he says, you did a wonderful job. He says, had it not been for you, this would not have come about. I said, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I said that I will take that as a compliment to the chamber board, and so I go pass that on to our board, which I did at the next meeting. I told them that we had a compliment from the mayor of the city. And so, again, like I say, I couldn't do those things alone. There's nobody that can do those things alone.
The mayor at that time was who?
Paul Brennan. As a matter of fact, I was not on city council at that time because I had ran the mayor against Mr. Brennan, and that's how I eventually, I guess, was, you might say, tapped for the chamber, but still working for the city, even though I wasn't in city council at that time. The cooperation that we had through the chamber, the city council, and they were just overwhelmed by the change of the community on this project. The businessmen were just absolutely in their glory. I mean, they just couldn't believe how, you know, things had changed. But again, like you say, it takes cooperation. It took the chamber, the city council, the business community, the individual citizens, everybody put their best foot forward and worked for something that has become a very, very viable part of the community. I would believe that without that having happened, that we might have been in some serious problems in Northville because of a lack of the business banking business section.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a strong business section, you will have a strong community.
All right. Somewhere in here, you said that you have been involved in many church activities. Would you like to tell me about that?
Well, I first belonged to Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church here in Northville, under there on the way. And I became involved in some of their projects, especially, well, let's go back to the beginning, I guess. Ever since I was small, I have been a member of Our Lady of Victory. I started out, of course, becoming an altar boy at the church there. Back in the days when Father Woodstock was here, I was, you might say, small. He organized little baseball teams and activities for the children, which I, of course, participated in. Kind of, in a sense, helped in a way that us older high school students, we would help Father to teach the smaller kids, you know, how to play the game and how to bat and things of this nature. It was just a real fun thing of trying to help one another through the church, because it was something that we couldn't do these things first in school. So this became a second, what shall I say, sports activity. And there for several years, of course, when I was not able to engage in sports because of my knee, this gave me a good outlet to be involved in some type of participation in the sport field. And I was able to do a few things like this to help out. Then after, when Father Hede became our pastor up here, I became very involved as an extraordinary minister at our church.
Could we interject a note here and say that that means that you are a communion minister?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Right. And then Father Haydad was a great believer in families and wanting to have them together at different things. So he had different activities, putting on, parties of some kind at the church. Well, of course, I became very involved with Father Haydad and helped to, organize these different activities, different parties, and things like that, along with other members of the congregation, of course. I was just a small part of it, because, again, cooperation. You get two people that have an idea, that's fine. But now, if you get five people that have that idea, you can carry it out. And this is really what we did. I mean, it was almost like a spider web. You know, you start out small, and then first thing you know, everybody becomes involved. And we had some very successful get-togethers. We started the annual church picnic, which is still carried on today. Father Dustin, the singing banjo-playing priest, we had him out with Alma Santa, who is a great accordionist. And we had them out several times for different types of get-togethers. My wife and which looks like cooks of the big spaghetti dinners that we had at our church. And excuse me, these are also little fundraisers to help pay for some of the activities that went on that actually were, you know, a cost to the church, and we of course couldn't dig into their treasury because they didn't have any for these type of things. So we had to have little fundraisers to pay these off, and this is how we did it. And so this is how our involvement through the church was for many years. My wife and I both participated in many of these activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Father Haydad left, unfortunately we didn't have that many things going on. So, and of course, younger people coming in, it's better for them to take over than from the soul folks.
I know what you're saying.
If something came up at the church that made me with my health, of course, I'd be most happy to, participate in those things again. But it's been fun, it's been good, it's been very educational, it's been very friendly and nice meeting a lot of the newer and younger people coming into the church that can continue these things, because it takes that type of thing to keep your people together.
Good. Now, you're past member of the Parents Council of Eastern Michigan University. How did that come about?
Well, that came about when my oldest daughter, Teresa, went to Eastern her first year of college. And they had a Parents' Day, of course, orientation day, that's what it was. And so, of course, my wife and I and Teresa went to that orientation day that they had for the new students and parents. During one of these sessions, they said that under the law, that the students were now 18, so the university would send their report cards and any information or anything about them to the student who sent it, and they couldn't tell the parents this. Well, that kind of, what should I say, upset me a little bit. And I said, wait, I says, are you telling me that you're not going to tell me what my daughter's doing over here at school? I said, no. I says, well, I think you're wrong. According to law, and I said, well, no, wait a minute. I said, let's go back a little bit. I says, Mom and Dad is footing the bills. So I says, I think somewhere along the line, I says, in the federal government IRS income tax form, it says in there, are we contributing more than 50% of a child's care and upbringing and education, automobiles, I said, whatever it may be. I said, we have the right to deduct them as a dependent. I said, now, second, I says, it also states when they go to vote, I says that the criteria for their voting is where is their address that's at home? Where is their driver's license? It's at home. So if home is their home for all of these things, which gives them the right, and gives me the right to claim a dependent, gives them the right to vote at home, locally, and state and federal, I says, and then, I says, in my business, insurance, I says, our criteria for charging for students away at school is, again, where are their is their home register? What is their post office mailing address? And the other criteria, let's see, those three. The voting address, oh, and the dependent of the parents. Okay? So now I said, if this is all allowed by IRS, the government, the state, because the state insurance laws say that, you know, the criteria that we use for these students on charging automobile rates and what have you not, and the parents' responsibility, because under the present laws, it says that this person is a student away at college, and as long as these criteria are met and they have an automobile accident, they can still come back and sue mother and father. I says, that's been proven in the courts already. I said, so now you're telling me that you won't tell me anything about what's happening with my daughter over here. I said, I think that's wrong. I says, and I challenge that. Well, they were a little taken back, you might say, by my statement. And so they said, well, now look, we've still got several hours before we get through with our orientation day. How would it be if we send this over to our school attorney and have him look into it? So about 2 hours later, when we had another sit-down orientation, then they came back and said, Mr. Plano, you were right, that you do have the right to your report cards and information from the school, because what you stated was right. So this is how that came about, and I guess it kind of set a precedent for all schools in the country, because of the fact that the parents then did have the right to obtain this information from the school. And I had then asked them that I want this stuff mailed to me. And so this is how that came about. And so then that's when they asked me if my wife and I would serve on the parents' council, because they were just starting that parents' council. And I think the previous year was the first year that we started it. And that was a council to help eliminate some of the red tape that students would have to go through on different things. We also had fundraisers to pay for different things at Eastern. Texas, it was for a seminar that was being held out there for some new courses. We had some grants for some of the students and things of this nature. And I remained on that council. My wife had to drop off because of the illness at the time. She just couldn't, you know, physically handle some of the things. And, but I remained on there for about 5 years. It was very rewarding experiences to go through, to see what some of the kids in college have to go through, or what they have to put up with, and how, in a sense, that, again, I call it politics, really, but they would try to do something or go to a counselor or go to the administration and say they're having a problem with this. And they said, well, we'll look into it and we'll let you know. Well, you know, it would be weeks and they still wouldn't hear. But a phone call from me or another member of the parents' council to the administration, that afternoon we had it looked up. I had one case I can remember where a student that knew me called and said, I'm having a very bad problem in my dorm. I've been after them to change me for weeks because one of the students in my section here is smoking pot and I don't want to be involved or anywhere near it. And she had, what shall I say, several weeks of trying to get changed. And I called over there that afternoon, and that evening she was sleeping in another dorm. and this is the type of thing that our parents council was able to accomplish to help the students there. Like I say, it's a very rewarding experience.
I'd like to go back to something that went on from 1954 to 58. Paul's Sweet Shop. Where was that located, and will you tell us something about it?
Yeah, that was a little sweet shop. It was a dairy bar. We had light lunches, you know, hamburgers, grill work stuff.
Where was that?
That was it started out at 168 East Main Street, and then the address was changed to 170. They had two different addresses because a new building was being built next door to us, and so therefore had to be, all addresses had to be changed. But it's where the present Main Street Barbers are today. And I believe that current address today is 170 East Main Street. And that was a kind of a novel, you might say, how that all came about. My grandfather in Rochester, Michigan at that time, or up until the time he was able to continue operating the store. This is what he had, was a confectionery store. And ice cream, soda bar. He had, of course, bread and milk, candies, and at that time, tobaccos were a big thing in those type of confectionery stores. And then my Uncle Patsy, Fabiano, my mother's brother, had the same type of store up in Holland, Michigan. Only in Holland, he made his own homemade candies. He dipped his own chocolates. And his big thing there, too, of course, was fruit, because his oldest son was in the produce business, the wholesale produce. So I've always, what shall I say, being every summer, I would go over to my grandpa's in Rochester and spend, at least 2 to 3 weeks summer vacationing with him and then putzing around in the store. Although grandpa was kind of a funny guy. He he wanted to do everything himself. He wouldn't let you do very much. I mean, about the only thing I guess I could really do without having to tie him down and press him into a corner to let me do something was go get the broom and sweep. But I can remember him having a machine that he pushed out in front of the store every morning, and at one end of his great big machine, he roasted peanuts, and on the other end of the machine, he popped popcorn. And I used to sit out there and sell the bags of popcorn and peanuts to the people walking up and down the street during the summer months, and that was a great thrill for me. But that was my main job while I was there. He took the inside store, I took the outside. But that was fun. And then Uncle Patsy, like I say, he started making his own homemade chocolates. He made his own homemade ice cream, which for many, many years was a big hit in homemade ice cream. Well, it started out here that the two drugstores that we had at that time, which was Dunzel's Rexall Drugs, and then Leo Mainville had bought out the Stewart drugstore, which then became known as Northwood Drugs. They both took out their soda fountains. And Leland Smith, who operated the old EMB food market, EMB stood for Edward M. Bogart. He's the one that started that grocery store. And that's where Gennetti's is presently today. Because Gennetti's eventually bought it from the chain of owners, from Ed Bogart to Leland Smith to Ray Girard, the line. And so Smitty is, everybody knew him as, and of course then was also a postmaster in Northville. And I were talking, and I wanted to go into business for myself someday in the future, because I always felt that if I could make money for somebody else, I should be able to make it for me. And so we had many talks, and the one thing that we came up with, which was more his idea than mine, really, was that if two soda fountains go out of business, why couldn't one survive? And the only other place that you could buy ice cream or sundaes was at the Cloverdale Dairy. And that we felt that there could be a successful second dairy store in town. And so that's when I then rented the building that I was in from Don McDonald.
On the other side of your cup.
Oh, you want to order? I can't get some. And so I eventually rented that building from her, and then bought the equipment from Dunzel's Rexall Drug, and got sealed test ice cream in, which I thought was one of the best ice creams. Then we set up shop, and that eventually became known as Ball Street Shop. Well, we operated that. It was a successful venture that we went into. It was hard work. We opened at 10 in the morning and closed at 10 at night. And of course, you were lucky to get out of there by midnight by the time you cleaned and mopped floors, especially in the wintertime. Every day you had to do those things. And then in 1952, I believe it was, I put some pizza ovens in and had the first pizza place in Western Wayne County. And my cousin, who owned a pizza place called Mount Joy Pizzeria over on Joy Road and Mount Street, he came out and taught me how to make the pizzas.
What was his name?
Stanley Pinderi. Now, my homemade chocolate business, that being about my Uncle Patsy Fabiano from Holland, came down and showed me how to, let's say, melt down the 10-pound slabs of chocolate and mix peanuts, raisins, coconut, whatever you wanted to make, and really chocolate melted down, you could make all these different candies. And of course, he had shown me how to do that. And that became a very successful part of our business because by the time I, of course, had left the sweet shop, I had seven other outlets that I wholesaled my own candy to, because we boxed our candies. And so we had some very nice stores. One of our biggest accounts was over at Wad Lake, the Buckmeyer's, what did they call it? Buckmeyer's Supermarket, I guess it was. And they sold a lot of our candy. And then we had Guernsey Farm Dairies, who had a couple of outlets, sold our candies. And then the old Farm Crest Farms Dairy, they had about five places, and they sold our candies in there. And so we had a very successful candy business built up. And then in 1958, I then sold out. To work for an uncle of mine, Frank Fabiano, who was from Buchanan, Michigan, and he took over the distributorship of the Rocco Horn-operated music boxes, or better known as jukeboxes, for the state of Michigan. And when he first opened his new office in Detroit, he wanted my wife to go to work for him, and then and he said as soon as we got, you know, totally set up with a showroom and everything, that he would like to have me come to work for him. And that kind of worked out well, because at that time I had a man who was interested in buying out my sweet shop. And so that's how I went from the sweet shop business to the jukebox business. And so,
did you enjoy that?
Yes, that was very interesting. That was, oh boy, what shall I say, still in the days of the, what would you call it, the war days of the jukebox industry, put it that way. There was still, we had a few incidences where jukeboxes were smashed up, and one place got bombed. Editor of ours at that time, the super distributorship, and there were still a few things like that going on. And when I say bond, it was somebody threw a very funny Molotov cocktails through the big front window, and of course the newspapers came out, jukebox senator bombed, you know.
What was the basis of that war?
Just competition.
Is that all?
It really turned out that, you know, one guy would be jealous of the other competitor and he'd try to steal his stop and get the owner of that place to put in his jukebox instead of the other guy's jukebox. And then they'd become mad at one another. And of course, there was a lot of stories of mafia relationships in there, of owning some of the routes and, you know, which I'm sure that there probably was, because like anything else, everybody's always out to try to make that fast buck. And I'm sure that some of these people, as I say, unscrupulous business people were involved in it. And of course, the union was involved in it. They tried to unionize all the workers and keep them from, so I say, fighting one amongst one another, try to cooperate a little bit more. But it wasn't near as bad as what the newspapers, you know, played it up to be. Could be that some of those things that happened would be that a guy would buy a machine. He probably bought a Seabird machine, and the thing gave him a lot of trouble, so he got mad and threw the cocktail bomb through the front window, you know. And that would be a one-time incident. I mean, you know, people buy a car today and it turns out to be a lemon. And, you know, there was an incident several years ago up in the new one, Telegraph Road or something. Guy had bought the car and it turned out to be a lemon, and ended up throwing rocks through the guy's front window. Well, it's no different, really. So, but that was a good business. But then I got seriously injured in it when I was lifting a machine when I really shouldn't have been. And I hurt my back. And in 1959, and I ended up at University Hospital, and was supposed to be there for about 10 days for some tests to find out why I was hurt so bad. And when they gave me a myelogram, a big 5-inch needle they put in the back door, it hit the wrong spot and I became paralyzed from my waist down for the next 2 years. And I laid on my back all that time. Eventually, through the hard work of my wife, I rubbed my back and my legs, tried to get the circulation back into them. I ended up with a guy at the University Hospital. I spent from December until the following week before I got up. So I spent over four and a half months. So then I came home, my dad and my brother, his name was Steve, he's the oldest, the three of us, Joe, they carried me out one arm over each shoulder. I was no longer could stay at the hospital. And then my cousin Monroe Weston, my next door neighbors were Patterson and some parents, better known as Pat. And Stan Johnson. And then my cousin Monroe would come down on Friday nights and pick me up and take me up to the football games or basketball games. And first basketball games, I couldn't, climb up into the bleachers, and they'd get a chair sit on the end of the bleachers for me. And my dad and my brother would stop over every night and pick me up and try to get me to move my legs, and so would my next door neighbors. Earl and some parents, they would also do that, and they took and eventually helped me to get back on the feet to walk again. My daughter was only, oldest daughter, Teresa, was only 5 months old at the time, and I just said that I did not want to lay on my back the rest of my life and watch her grow up.
It's amazing. You did it on drive and desire.
Dr. Westerberg at University Hospital, I told her that when I was leaving, she didn't want me to leave. And I said, I can't stay here because you're not doing me any more good. I said, I gotta go home and work on this myself. And I used to, my wife was working at that time. She had to work in order for us to survive. And the folks would take care of her daughter, and I would be home, and I'd crawl around on my hands and knees trying to exercise myself, you might say, and then I would get stood up in front of a kitchen chair, and then use a kitchen chair as my crutch to lean on. And it took about 2 years, and at that time I went back to University Hospital, and I walked into Dr. Westerberg's office, and needless to say, she was very shocked. So I told her that someday I was going to golf again, and that I was going to bowl again. And I, of course, could no longer carry the high average or shoot as good a golf as I used to. I used to shoot good bowling with an average in the 190s. And I used to golf in the mid to high 70s. Of course, today, whatever score I achieve is an accomplishment, because for many years, and the doctor said I would never do that again. So whatever I bowl or golf today, I just feel that...
Well, you're punching. You must do a lot of walking, though.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I do a lot of tracking, a lot of swimming. I guess it was, if I recall right, about 7 years before I attempted to play golf again. And at that time, at the end of 7 holes, I had to quit. The only way I had to get up to play it. I walked in from 7 holes to the other one, and the swimming ball just hurt so bad. Of course, I wore a plaster cast from my waist up over the top of my shoulders for 2 years. And then I wore a steel brace for about, I would say, close to 8 to 10 years after that.
Uh-huh.
I still have trouble today.
With your back?
But with my back, but I learned to cope with it and do some of the things that helps to pressure when it starts to be bad on me. Still doctored with it. I think, which I say, at times I had to consume a lot of aspirin to help ease the pain. But it's something that I've learned to live with.
All right, so it was probably in about 1958, or whenever you came out of the hospital. started your insurance business.
I got into the insurance business in 1961. Mm-hmm. And I had to look for something that I no longer had to do, which was a hard physical labor. I could have gone back into the jukebox business, selling jukeboxes and taking you might say traveling the state on the jukebox sales and what have you not, but that would have been a very hard thing because I'd have to take the machine with me and demonstrate the voice to the operators throughout the state. And you might say trying to put that machine in and out of the back of the station wagon, and at times I'm sure it would have been by myself, would have been a little bit too hard. And that's when seen an ad in the local newspaper, and I followed up on that, which eventually led to my state.
Well, it looks as if you've been very successful. You've been in it about 27 years.
27 and a half years. It's like any other business, though. You only get out of it what you put into it. And it was the same thing at the sweet shop. If I wasn't there working every day, I couldn't make a go of it. If I'm not here working hard in my insurance business, I couldn't make a go of it.
Well, it's a very competitive business.
Very competitive, and your normal turnover of your clientele, just from the standpoint of moving in and out of the community, you might say, that alone will probably consume close to 15% of your business per year. Other factors, families have two or three cars, daughter, son gets married, moves away, we lose one of those cars. Competition, rate-wise, right off the road, you know, naturally take some of your business. Moves, people, transfer of jobs, you lose their business. You lose a family that's got five cars, a home, a cottage, two snowmobiles, a motorcycle, and all of a sudden the guy gets transferred to Wisconsin. You know, so you have to write a lot of new business to offset. I guess almost 20% is a pretty average loss of business per year.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to work hard to replace that. And so if you don't replace it, you go backwards. And this is one business you can't do that in.
Do either of your daughters work for
you? Excuse me. My daughter, Paula, works for me. She's a student, of course, at U of M, so she works part-time. And depending on her class schedule, she may come back during midweek and definitely on weekends. Of course, when she has no classes, she's over here working. My oldest daughter, I should say both my daughters started working for their dad when they were about 7 or 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
They learned how to file, and so they were my file clerks for all the years that they grew up, you might say. My oldest daughter now, Teresa Ann, she is a claim representative for the State Farm Insurance Companies out of the Pontiac Claims Office. So she is state with State Farm. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised someday that maybe Paula might even. You know, it's hard to say, although music is her major, and she loves the music industry, and of course she does a lot of singing, and so she, I'm sure, will pursue a musical background for her future.
Well, you certainly have been a mover and shaker in Northville. It's really interesting. You've been a great interview. It took just a few questions, and I got lots of wonderful material for the Historical Society and for the library.
Well, I remember all my youth days here. It's it's really been wonderful living in North Carolina. I've had several opportunities over the years of moving because of work, and but I just never felt like I wanted to leave North Carolina. And I can remember in the wintertime when we used to get good icy weather, starting out up on top of the East Lawn Sand Hills, or the East Lawn Sanitarium is where Elmer Terrace is now.
Oh, all right. Mm-hmm.
And we used to slide from the top of that hill, from right down High Street, all the way down to Main Street on our sleds, turn left on Main Street down to Center Street, and end up down at, well, which is a 7 mile cutoff, but Edward Hines Drive and South Center Street.
In one run?
In one run.
You didn't have to be a skier.
Oh, no. Well, we used to ski the old Baldwin's Hill, which is the hill then that goes up, which is Sheldon Road.
Mm-hmm.
And the first hill on your left-hand side there, that was called Baldwin's Hill, and we used to ski that and sled the East Lawn Sand. And those were good days that we had. A lot of the kids from North Carolina, this is what their entertainment was, is doing things like that during the winter months because we didn't have the money to be able to go to shows every night, or there was no place, really, you might say, recreation departments were unheard of at that time. And the only thing that there was a few activities at the school which did not involve other than the sports and basketball, football, and baseball. And so we had to find our own entertainment. Those were some of the things that we did.
That's great. I see so many children being very passive these days, spending all their time in front of the TV and with these Nintendos and things like that.
The only thing we had back then was to be able to listen to a radio. And the only time that we could do that is when our parents went listening to the news, and then we could listen to certain programs. But I can remember my oldest brother, Steve, of course, and then my older sister, Jenny, who still lives in Northville. Her married name today is Watson. And she, my brother, and I, walk to school, and of course, other than when we were at different buildings, you might say at that time, but we'd always walk to school with our neighbor children, you might say, who their brothers and sisters were walking together, which was really, what shall I say, not as was common then, but not today.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was no buses back then, so people that lived out in the country would bus in their own children and neighborhood children. They flew back together. It was, let's say, going back to many, many different things that went on over the years that I was involved in. First, but of course, was a the Retail Merchants Association. And, I guess they kind of hoped to get the city to buy some of the properties that we did back then for parking, because my grandfather's home over in Rochester was eventually bought out by the city of Rochester for parking. Suggested that to the city council because we didn't have enough parking. And then for several years when business was bad, that time I was on the city council, that people were going to recall us out of office because we bought so much parking lots that they were never filled.
Oh,
and now, I guess
there's
people,
a great shortage.
Yeah, now today I guess the people want to recall us from office again, because we don't have enough parking today.
Right.
So I've seen our community go from, what shall I say, the best to the worst to the best to the worst or whatever you want to call it, but it just seems like it's gone in cycles.
It's a live wire community.
Yes, it is. It's really a very, very good community, and the cooperation with the people here in town has just been tremendous, because without it, we wouldn't have what we have today in North Carolina.
I've been here 11 years next week, and I have enjoyed it completely. Really, really enjoyed it.
That's the reason I never left Northbrook.
We're running out of tape here, and I would like to thank you on behalf of the Historical Society and the library for a very interesting interview. Really, really interesting.
Thank you. It's been nice of you to come down and
well, it will become part of the archives. Both organizations, the Historical Society and